John chapter 11. We're looking at the raising of Lazarus. We're actually going to get to the raising of Lazarus this evening. Just by way of quick review, remember we started out with the death of Lazarus in verses 1 through 16 of chapter 11. And we noted that Jesus had just left Jerusalem because there was a threat on his life. And we had that in chapter 10 and verse 39 where it says, "Therefore they were seeking again to seize him, and he eluded their grasp." So he left Jerusalem under threat of death, and Mary and Martha now are going to call him back to Bethany, which is what we would call a suburb of Jerusalem. It was about 2 miles away. And his response in verse 4 through 6 is kind of interesting because it says, "Therefore, when he heard that Lazarus was sick," and that's what Mary and Martha told him, "Your friend Lazarus is sick." It says, when he found out his friend was sick, he stayed 2 days longer instead of going down to Jerusalem right away. And then the plan in verse 7 through 10 was that he was going to require the disciples to trust him. And then the purpose in 11 through 16, look at verse 14 and 15, for example, when it says, "So Jesus then said to them plainly, 'Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him.'" So that's the plan. So now they're going down to Bethany, and he meets up with Mary and Martha. Martha first, of course. In the setting, Lazarus has been dead now for 4 days. Remember, verse 17 says, "So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days." And remember, they had that Jewish line of thought or Jewish belief that the soul stayed around the body for 3 days, but after that, there was no chance of revival. The Jews thought that if within 3 days the soul kind of wanted to get back in the body and hang around, but after that fourth day, there was no chance. So he waited 4 days to make absolutely sure that everybody there believed there was no chance of him just resuscitating. He was just in a coma. You know, they didn't have the medical equipment and the medical expertise that we have today. So 4 days was adequate to make sure that he was absolutely dead. So Jesus, first he meets with Martha, of course, because Martha was the one always bustling around. Mary was the one that was always back in the house, and we find that's where she was here. And as he talks to Martha, he gives one of the greatest sentences in the whole book of John in verse 25 and 26 when he said, "Jesus said to her, 'I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?'" So resurrection and life are so closely associated with Jesus that he doesn't say, "I'm responsible for the resurrection." He says, "I am the resurrection and the life." Then he goes on to say, "He who believes in me shall live even if he dies." That explains the resurrection part. And then he goes on, "He who lives and believes will never die." And that's the life part. So he makes the statement and then he goes on to explain it. Now, with Mary, Jesus has a short visit with Mary in 28 to 32. And then in verse 33 through 37, they're on their way to the tomb, and in these verses, Jesus shows his human nature, and this is for the first time. He hasn't been very emotional up to now about Lazarus, but now, in 33 through 37, he shows his human nature. Remember, Jesus was perfect humanity as well as perfect deity. He was all man. He was all God. And in verse 33, it says, "When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled." So Jesus was angry, and that's what that boils down to. Remember that deeply moved, meant to snort like a horse? It indicated anger. And he's angry at the unnaturalness of death. And it just makes him mad to see that it is so devastating to people. You know, they're crying and crying. And we have in verse 35, that very famous shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. Even he wept that his friend had Lazarus had to go through that unnatural thing called death. So, no, obviously Jesus wasn't crying because he was missing his friend, because he knew he was going to see him in a minute or two. So he was crying about the unnaturalness of death. Now, after he's shown his human nature, it's where we left off last time, and now Jesus is going to show his divine nature. And he'll do that by performing a miracle. And that miracle will be the raising of Lazarus in verse 38 through 44. Let's read those verses starting at verse 38. It says, "So Jesus, again, being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and a stone was laying against it. And Jesus said, 'Remove the stone.' Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, 'Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days.' Jesus said to her, 'Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?' So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, 'Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it so that they may believe that you sent me.' When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come forth.' The man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, 'Unbind him and let him go.'" So that's the miracle itself. We'll notice in verse 38 and 39, the preparation. In verse 39, Jesus said, "Remove the stone." And Martha, the sister of the deceased, and the word deceased in verse 39 is a perfect tense participle. And that stresses the fact that Lazarus was dead. Remember, perfect tense means an action that happened in the past, but it still has abiding results. So he's saying that Lazarus had died and he was still dead. It's emphasizing the completeness of his death, the abiding condition of his death. A more literal translation of this verse would be, or of Martha's response in this verse anyway, would be, "Lord, by this time he is stinking because he is a fourth day man." In other words, he's been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, the Jews used spices on the bodies of their dead, but they did not embalm like the Egyptians did. So these spices did not prevent decomposition. So the body would be decomposing. They didn't use embalming techniques. And the promise in verse 40 is, Jesus said to her, did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So the primary issue here is the glory of God. He doesn't say, "Didn't I say to you, if you believe, you will see the raising of Lazarus?" He doesn't say that at all. He says, "If you believe, you will see the glory of God." Because everybody there was going to see the raising of Lazarus, whether they were believers or not, is not the issue. But they, the unbelievers there, would not see the significance. Only the believers would see that. So that's why Jesus said, "If you believe, you'll see the glory of God." So the unbelievers, what are they going to see? A man come out of a tomb. And they're going to say, "Wow, that's a neat trick. How do you do that?" The believers are going to see a dead man brought back to life, and they're going to see the glory of God in that. The prayer in verse 41 and 42, and we note this several times throughout the book of John, that when Jesus addresses God, he doesn't do it in the way that we do. He says in verse 41, Jesus raised his eyes and said, Father. He doesn't say, Our Father. He says, Father. He has a very special relationship with God the Father. Remember in chapter 20 when it's talking about his resurrection, when he said, I have to go to my Father and your Father? He doesn't say, Our Father, because he has a very different, special relationship with God the Father. And here in John chapter 11, when he prays, he treats the prayer as if it's already been heard. Verse 41, the last part says, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. So he's praying as if the prayer is already heard. He had prayed according to God's will, and he knew it was according to God's will. Therefore, the hearing of the prayer, it was a done deal. He knew it was heard. Now, the prayer was for the benefit of those around him. It wasn't for him. It says in verse 42, I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it, so that they may believe that you sent me. In other words, the Father and the Son are in contact. He doesn't have to look upwards and say, Father, to pray. But he did that so the people standing around would know and would come to believe. And that may believe in verse 42 translates an aorist tense verbal. They may come to a point of belief. It's come to an act of believing. It's not a process. It's an act. You believe the gospel message and you're saved. Now in verse 43 and 44 we have the resurrection. 43 says, when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And that's the Greek there. And it's kind of interesting. It's a proper noun, Lazarus. That's proper noun, Lazarus' name. And duro means over here. And exo means outside. So there's no verb, again. He just says, Lazarus, over here, outside. Now, it says in verse 43, when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice. And it's kind of interesting. Why do you suppose he used a loud voice? Have to talk pretty loud for a dead person to hear you, right? No, that's not why he used a loud voice. He used it to distinguish himself from the other magicians and sorcerers of the day. Look back in Isaiah chapter 8. It was to emphasize his confidence. In Isaiah chapter 8, we see the contrast in verse 19. Verse 19, it says, when they say to you, consult the mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter. Could not a people consult their God? So the other magicians, the sorcerers, the wizards, they muttered their incantations. But Jesus doesn't. He just says in a very loud voice, Lazarus, over here, outside. Now notice, interesting point, getting back to John chapter 11, that Lazarus comes out bound hand and foot. Now some people say, and I'm one of this school of thought, that this is a miracle within a miracle. He was wrapped in grave clothes, and they wrapped him and put spices in him and wrapped him around, and he came forth. Now, how do you suppose he came forth? Do you picture Lazarus as kind of hopping like a bunny out the door because he can't move his legs and running into things because his face is covered with a cloth? I don't picture it that way at all. I picture it as Jesus saying, Lazarus, over here, outside, and bang, there was Lazarus, over here and outside. So a miracle within a miracle, he kind of beamed him out of the grave, if you want to call it that. Because he goes on to say, verse 44, the man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. So Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. He's standing there all bound up still in his grave clothes. He can't see. He's got his face covered. So Jesus says, get the bindings off of him and let him go. Now that's the miracle itself. Now we get to the repercussions of this miracle. This will be the final straw, so to speak, in the Sanhedrin's on the Sanhedrin's back. And they're going to finally decide now that this guy has got to go. And this is what's going to do it. In verse 45 through 57, we have the repercussions of the miracle. Let's read those verses now, starting at 45. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish. Now he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. First, let's look at the repercussions on the people. 11:45, many believed in him. And those are the ones who, when they saw him, they saw the glory of God. They didn't just see a guy coming out of a tomb because somebody did a neat trick. They saw the glory of God and they believed in Jesus. When it says in verse 45, it says, therefore many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done, believed in him. That little phrase, believed in him, is John's favorite for talking about saving faith. When he talks about saving faith, believed is a word in the aorist tense. Again, it means it was done at a point of time. It was an act, not a process. In the preposition that shows where that belief was directed, and him is the accusative case. That points to the object of the belief. And that's John's favorite way of saying these guys came to a saving faith. And as a result, there was division. The miracle created division. Jesus always created divisions. When he did a miracle, when he spoke, when he talked about doctrine, always, always divisions. Verse 46. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. We talked about this Sunday. Divisions aren't necessarily a bad thing. And if you weren't here, look at 1 John chapter 2. And we'll just look at that momentarily. And it says, too, that truth always creates division. That's what truth does. Some believe it and some don't. So truth always creates divisions. And in 1 John 2 and verse 19, it says, they went out from us, but they were not really of us. For if they had been of us, they would have remained with us. But they went out so that it would be shown that they are all not of us. Now this is taken out of context, hard to understand, but what John is saying here, and he's talking about the antichrists, the false teachers in his day, and he's saying that they went out from the circle of the apostles, that John was in. That's the us. He says they went out from us. And they did that, and there was a purpose. God had a reason for that. And that is so that it would be shown that they are all not of us. So he's saying that they had a division over truth. And you can tell it's over truth because in verse 21 it says, I have not written to you because you do not know the truth, but because you do know it. These guys that were part of the apostolic circle in John's day left that circle and were teaching false doctrine. And that had a reason. The reason was to show that they didn't know truth, that their doctrine was false. So division, not always a bad thing. And if it's over doctrine, if it's over truth, then divisions can be a good thing. Even church divisions. Is it always a bad thing that the church divides? Not always. Sometimes it is. I remember one case of a church dividing because they couldn't decide which way. They're building a new church and couldn't decide which side to put the door on. So they had a church. There's a little more to that story, but that's what it basically boiled down to. And that's not what this is talking about. This is saying if we have major divisions over doctrine, then division is appropriate. Because when Jesus spoke truth, it always caused division. Always. So the other group, many believed in him, some, and I say told on him, but that's kind of a bad way to put it, because it says in 46, verse 46, some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Now, when you read the commentaries on this verse, a lot of the commentaries will say, well, they obviously went out of hostility because they knew the Pharisees didn't like Jesus. So they went and ratted him out would be probably the expression we would use. But there's nothing that says that. It just says they went and told the Pharisees. Others say, you know, the Pharisees were the religious experts. And if you saw a guy get up out of the grave like Lazarus did, that would be the natural place you'd go, what's going on here? What is it with this guy? Is he the real deal? The fact is, you can't prove it one way or another. And the other fact is, it doesn't really matter one way or the other. But one thing can be said about these guys, and that is, they did not have faith. Now notice they're contrasted with the ones who believed. In verse 45, many believed, but some of them went to the Pharisees. That would be the ones that didn't believe. So when they saw the raising of Lazarus, they didn't see the glory of God. All they saw was a dead guy come back to life. Now the repercussions then on the leaders of nation Israel, we'll put it in two categories, general and specific. First, general, what did it have on the council? And second, Caiaphas in particular. So in general, in 47 and 48, they called a council. And this council, it could refer to an informal meeting that they just called, but most probably it refers to a meeting of the Sanhedrin, an official meeting of the Sanhedrin, the leading group of the Jewish nation. And that's the word that's used in verse 7 when it says they convened a council. It's the word Sanhedrin. So the chief priests and the Pharisees were there. Their reaction is kind of interesting. In verse 47, it gives their reaction. It says, therefore the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. What's their reaction? What are we doing? Nothing. But this guy's performing miracle after miracle after miracle, and we're not doing anything. Notice, they don't even consider thinking of Jesus as the real deal. Says, what are we going to do about this? This guy's doing miracles. So if you're not going to believe, no amount of evidence will convince. Well, these guys, they even admitted the miracles. So he's doing miracle after miracle after miracle. What are we going to do about this guy? They come to a conclusion That's verse 48. It says, if we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So the first conclusion is that if they just let Jesus keep on doing miracles, that everybody's going to believe him. Now, the all men is an exaggeration here, but it shows just how worried these guys were. I mean, they were pretty seriously worried. They said, if that happens, everybody's going to believe him, and they'll set him up as their head. Well, what does that do to the Sanhedrin? I mean, these guys had really cushy jobs, and they were very well respected. And we'll see in a moment, that was their chief concern. What's this going to mean to us? Their second conclusion would be that if everybody believes Jesus and sets him up as their leader, that the Romans are going to see this as sedition, because Rome selected the leaders. They chose the high priest, basically, or chose who could be a high priest in Israel. And if the people set up Jesus as their leader, Rome would just storm in and crush nation Israel. And then where would they be? Now Caiaphas comes on the scene. Verse 49 to 53. Caiaphas, he was the official high priest at the time of Jesus. His term lasted from AD 18 to 36. And he was the son-in-law of Annas. Annas was a former high priest, but Annas still held a lot of power. Look at John 18, for example. Start at verse 12. It says, So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first. So this guy still had a lot of power. For he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. So they took him to Annas first, even before Caiaphas. And he sent him on, of course, to Caiaphas. But this guy still had a great deal of power. So did Caiaphas. He was the high priest. And back to John chapter 11, we note that Caiaphas was a Sadducee. He wasn't a Pharisee. Remember the difference. The Pharisees were more the religious part, and the Sadducees were more the political types. The Pharisees knew the law backwards, forwards, inside out, and upside down. The Sadducees knew how to work the system, so to speak. So they're the ones that were in control of the Sanhedrin. And Caiaphas, he was a Sadducee, so he was very powerful. Just as a note about the Sadducees, they were noted for being rude. And you can see that in verse 49. It says, but one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all. And that's how it comes across in Greek, because he uses a double negative. He says, nothing. You guys know nothing. Just typical rudeness. You all know Josephus, the Jewish historian. He said this about the Sadducees. I'll just read this little note out of Morris's commentary. The Sadducees are, even among themselves, rather boorish in their behavior, and in their intercourse with their peers, they are as rude as to aliens. So, you know, just your typical, I'm a big shot and you're nothing type guys. And that's what he's saying to the Pharisees here. You guys don't know squat. He continues to berate them in verse 50. He says, nor do you take account that it is expedient for you. And that word take into account, that's the word legizomai. Remember that from Romans 4, the imputation word? That's an accounting term, and it means to reckon, to put on one's account. He's saying, you guys can't even work this out. You can't even work out what's best for you. That's when we get the hint as to what is the real concern here. Are these guys concerned about what's right and what's wrong? Are they concerned about nation Israel? Well, it says in verse 50, nor do you take into account what is expedient for you. So the real issue here is these guys have really cushy jobs. They have high-level positions. They're very, very important in nation Israel. And if the masses follow Jesus and set him up as their leader, and Rome comes in and crushes Israel, they'll disband the Sanhedrin and send these guys packing. And that's their real problem. That's what they're worried about, their privileged position. Now, verse 50, Caiaphas says, nor do you take an account that is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish. His conclusion is that it's better for one man, no matter if he's guilty or innocent, that has nothing to do with it. Does he do real miracles or not? That has nothing to do with it. You know, is he who he says he is or not? Doesn't matter. But it's better for you if he dies than the whole nation. John inserts his comments here in verse 51 and 52. These words are a prophecy. Caiaphas, of course, didn't know it, but he was prophesying that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And we see that in verse 51 and 52. And again, these two verses are John's comments on what Caiaphas said. 51 says, now he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Now, John attributes the source of his words to God when he says they were not spoken under his own initiative. And he goes on in verse 52 to add what Caiaphas left out. Caiaphas said Jesus would die for the nation, for Israel. But in verse 52, John says, not only Israel, but in order that he might also gather into one the children of God. So he's talking about the Gentiles too. And he adds that in, point out that substitutionary death is going to be bigger than just for nation Israel. It extends clear to the Gentiles. Now the result of all this, in verse 53, is that Caiaphas' words got through to the council. Verse 53 said, so from that day on, they planned together to kill him. So now they know what they have to do. The words got through to the council. Now, what's the repercussion on Jesus? And this is interesting. In verse 54 through 57, it says, therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness into a city called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now, the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover to purify themselves. So they were seeking Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, what do you think, that he will not come to the feast at all? Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was to report it so they might seize him. Notice in verse 54 it says, therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews. They had a hit order out for him, I guess, or a seize order. They were going to snatch him as soon as they saw him. So he didn't walk publicly. Why? He's Jesus. I mean, he could have zapped them all into smoldering ashes with just a thought. Why did he do that? Well, over and over we've said that the sovereignty of God does not preclude the action of men or the use of means. And we're going to see that Sunday too, concerning the Holy Spirit. God uses means. He kind of hid out, even though he could have killed them all. Remember my old saying? When you pray for potatoes, reach for the hoe. That's kind of the what explains this. Sovereignty does not preclude man's actions. And that's why the therefore is there. Because Jesus, he didn't walk publicly among the Jews anymore. Now the Jews, it says, because the Passover was near, went out to the countryside to purify themselves. And that could take up to a week. That's why they were coming early for the Passover. Ceremonial defilement, you know, disqualified anyone from participating in the Passover. If you were ceremonially defiled for one reason or another, you know, touching a dead body was a ceremonial defilement. Did you ever wonder, look over at Matthew 23. Matthew 23, 27. And I thought this was kind of interesting. It says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs." And they whitewashed the tombs so that they would be very apparent, so nobody would accidentally wander into one and touch a dead body. That's why they whitewashed the tombs. Just an interesting side note that I found out this week, and I thought it was kind of fun. But anyway, they were purifying themselves for Passover. Now, in verse 57, we see that even not telling where Jesus was, if you knew it, would be considered a crime. Verse 57 says, "Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, that he was to report it so that they might seize him." Now that brings us then to chapter 12. And chapter 12 will be the close of Jesus' public ministry. And we'll do just a preview and then pick it up next time. But as a preview, John selects three final events to conclude Jesus' public ministry. Three final events. Now, chapter 13 to 17 will be what are called the farewell discourses of Jesus. So John chooses, and remember, John's the doctrinal book. He's not so much historical. So he chooses events that will have doctrinal significance. And he chooses these three things to show the end of Jesus' ministry. First, he chooses the anointing at Bethany, and that'll be in 12, 1 through 8. And then in verse 9 through 19, the triumphal entry. And in verse 20 through 36, the visit of the Greeks. And those will be the three concluding events in the public ministry of Jesus. And we'll pick those up next week. Father, thank you again for your word, and thank you for this book of John. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.